This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Helldivers 4, Wolves, by Nicholas Sansbury Smith. This book is read by R.C. Bray. For those that battle the darkness, may you see the light. Never stop fighting. Luck is a very thin wire between survival and disaster, and not many people can keep their balance on it. Hunter S. Thompson. 1. The third day of the sky-pelting rain was when Xavier Rodriguez felt the first tingle of annoyance. Over the years, he had become a very patient man. Trekking across the radioactive wastes for the better part of a decade allowed him to claim patience as a virtue. But by the fifth and sixth day of rain, his patience was nearing its end. He hated being cooped up in a boat, and the new storm brewing overhead wasn't helping his mood any. Sitting around gave him plenty of time to think. There were still moments of deep anger and resentment when he reflected on those 10 long and perilous years on the surface. For hours at a time on the journey, he found himself either lost in his thoughts or jerking away from the nightmare images. Lightning webbed across the horizon, a welcome distraction from the memories. Each rumble of thunder shook the sea wolf with a gentle vibration. X sat in the control room, eyeing his enameled mug on the dashboard. The precious contents sloshed inside, blending the tea spiked with good old shine from the hive. Miles, his trusty Siberian husky hybrid, sat on the floor, muzzle on his paws, crystal blue eyes glancing up every few minutes. The twin hulls flanking the command center groaned as the two turbo engines pushed the craft through the heaving seas that slapped the port side. X flipped a switch on the dashboard, and the high beams lanced through the inky darkness, illuminating waves like snow-capped mountains as far as he could see. The reinforced fiberglass and metal frame suddenly didn't seem all that sturdy. He considered taking the boat off autopilot, but didn't want to risk veering off course. So he tried to relax in his leather seat and put his trust in Timothy Pepper, the AI program guiding the Seawolf. A glance at the on-screen map showed they were still sailing east of an island once known as Cuba. They had already passed through the dark Bahamas, with no sign of the metal islands or the Cazador ships. He checked the circular navigation monitor on the control panel to look for landmasses, other vessels, or mutant creatures that he assumed lived in the cold, dark waters. A green light blinked, revealing no contacts. The view through the windshield revealed nothing but open water, as far as he could see. While he wasn't at all opposed to having an uneventful first leg of their maiden voyage, he was starting to get bored. He twisted in his chair at the screech of the hatch opening. Magnolia Khatib stood in the entryway, a hand on her pale forehead.
"How you feeling, kid?"
X asked. "How's it look?" She lurched over to the other chair. Slumping against the cushioned leather, she let out a groan.
"I think I prefer diving to sailing."
To conserve energy, X flipped the lights off on the dashboard. The dark waves stretched into dark infinity, making it difficult to see where the ocean ended and the sky began. If not for the sporadic flashes of lightning, it would have felt as if they were sailing through the void of space.
"I always wanted to see the ocean," Magnolia said, "but this really sucks. I've puked 4 times this morning."
X gave her a quick glance. Her short-cropped hair, dyed blue, hung over her sapphire blue eyes. It used to give X the creeps, but he had warmed to her style.
"Better drink some water to stay hydrated," he said.
They had a good supply of water and a recycler unit to help it last, but at this rate, she would need more than her daily ration.
"Yeah, yeah."
She turned her attention back to the dashboard, tapping the fuel gauge monitor with a purple fingernail.
"Is this right?"
"What?"
X leaned over to double-check.
"Looks like battery 2 is losing power," she said. "Why didn't Timothy warn us?"
"Pepper," X said. "He was annoying me, so I shut him off."
Frowning, Magnolia swiveled her seat to another section of the control panel and hit a button. The AI's voice broke over the speakers.
"Good afternoon, Miss Khatib and Mr. Xavier."
"X. I told you to call me X."
"My apologies, sir."
"Just X,"
he said in a voice just shy of a shout.
Magnolia smirked, giving X a cockeyed glance.
He's really getting on your nerves, isn't he?
I'm not used to robots.
Timothy, what's the deal with the battery power? Magnolia asked, returning her attention to the monitor.
The boat, as you may know, is equipped with two batteries that charge the twin turbo engines, Timothy said.
X groaned.
Cut to the chase, pal.
After a pause, Timothy continued. Battery 2 has malfunctioned, although I'm not certain of the cause. It may require a manual assessment, as it could be something as simple as a faulty sensor. X checked the gauge for Battery 2. Sure enough, Mags and the AI were right. It was down to 25%. But how the hell could that happen, and how had he missed it? Both batteries were lithium-ion, and Chief Engineer Sampson had said they were two of the best ever recovered from the surface.
Shit, X said.
His tone drew the attention of Miles, who glanced up from his paws and then went back to sleep after letting out an exasperated sigh. X could empathize. Despite having spent most of the journey in his chair or his bunk, he was exhausted. Boredom had a way of creating fatigue, leading to mistakes, and even in these churning seas, X was bored as hell. He wasn't used to being cooped up in a small vessel, and part of him missed the freedom of roaming the wastes, although he didn't miss the hive one bit.
"I'm going topside," he said, unbuckling his harness.
Magnolia's eyebrow went up.
"You serious?"
Her eyes flitted back to the windshield.
"In this downpour? Can't this wait?"
"No," he said firmly.
Truth be told, X wasn't overly worried about the lithium-ion batteries. He just needed some space and air. He was used to being on his own, and as much as he appreciated Magnolia wanting to join him on this adventure, he missed his solitude, and the AI was getting under his skin. X moved over to check the readout on the main monitor, looking closely for radiation and any trace of mercury in the rain. Both were in the yellow zone, and he decided he would suit up on the second deck above them.
"Stay here, boy," he said to Miles.
The dog let out a whine and sat on his hind legs, watching as X prepared to leave the room.
"Be careful," Magnolia said, wrapping a strand of blue hair behind her ear.
"Shall I assist you, X?" Timothy asked.
"Nope. You just keep us from capsizing, okay, mate?"
Timothy's hologram flickered and then smiled.
"Mate? That's a new term to me, and I'm pleased to find in my database that it means friend."
X shook his head as he stepped out into the narrow hallway below decks. He didn't trust the AI, or any other robot with a conscience. If Katrina hadn't insisted, he would never have allowed the program on board. But he couldn't deny that Pepper was useful, especially when it came to guiding the Seawolf through rough weather. The hatch clicked shut behind X, and he made his way past his quarters on the left. Magnolia had taken the quarters on the right. The third room included a shared eating space with a stove, small kitchenette, and oval table where they ate most of their meals. The next two rooms were bathrooms, and aft of these, a maintenance room and storage closet where they stockpiled their extra rations and medical supplies. He climbed the ladder to the second cabin, which they had transformed into a staging area for future missions. Racks of weapons were bolted to the bulkhead on his right. Brand new submachine guns, a spear gun, and even fishing rods were stocked and secured throughout the room. Crates bolted to the deck contained scuba gear, life jackets, and buoys. X made his way over to the crate containing his suit, armor, and helmet. The metal gleamed in the overhead light, but the polishing did little to obscure the scratches, dents, and other abuse inflicted during his decade on the surface. After throwing on his new suit, he donned the trusty old armor. Back on the hive, when Michael Everhart had asked him whether he wanted new gear, X had declined. Why give up something that had saved your life countless times? The gear was old, sure, but he had made modifications to his helmet and battery unit that made it more useful than ever before. He secured the helmet, clicking it into place, and made his way to the rack of weapons, opting for an automatic rifle with a grenade launcher attachment. He left the bandolier of grenades on the rack, slung the gun over his shoulder, and spun the wheel handle to open the hatch to the weather deck. Gusting wind peppered his suit with rain. He fought his way out onto the 70-foot-long deck using the glow from lightning flashes. A fork speared through the sky and into a wave.
The glow lit up the stern. X examined his handiwork. Two strands of razor wire were looped around the rails to dissuade any mutant beasts lurking in the seas from coming aboard. Three spear guns were mounted on the deck in slots retrofitted from fishing pole mounts. X had welded them on himself, taking a lesson from the Cazadores, who had mounted such weapons on their ships. In the center of the deck stood a 20-foot mast with a crow's nest at the top. There was a second mast in the stern, but neither had sails up right now, and they weren't extended to full length to present less of a target for lightning. Chinning his compad, he opened the channel to the command center.
Mags, you copy?
Copy that.
I'm on deck and headed to the engine compartment.
Please try to keep water out of the compartment, mate, Timothy said. X chuckled in spite of himself.
Let's lay off the mate, okay?
Okay.
X. Please be careful, X, Magnolia added. There was trepidation in her voice. Not that he blamed her for being nervous at this point. She was sick as a dog, and he was starting to think she regretted coming along.
X uncoiled a rope from the bulkhead outside the hatch and looped it through two carabiners. He tested the hitch before setting out across the slick deck, keeping his eye on the silhouette of a Siberian husky painted on the deck not far from the mast. The name Seawolf was painted on the rectangular hatch that opened into the guts of the boat. That was his objective. The sails were stored inside the compartment, close to the engine and battery units. The only access was from the hatch he was walking toward. Battling the fierce winds, he slowly made his way forward. Beneath his boots, the entire boat rattled from the booming thunder. A wave slammed into the starboard side, sending a cascade of water over his armor. The shower didn't bother him, but he did fear taking a bath in the ocean. He made cautious progress, pulling on the rope for slack on his way to the hatch. Bending down, he grabbed the handle and prepared to open it when the vessel crested a wave. X braced for impact. The boat continued rising, then crashed back down with enough force to knock X off his feet. Water came over the side, hitting him with the force of a hurtling siren. He scrambled back to the hatch and wiped his visor with a gloved hand.
"Be advised I'm picking up a heavy electrical disturbance about 2 knots southwest," Timothy said.
"You picked a crappy time to go topside," Magnolia stuttered over the comm channel.
"Just keep us steady, Pepper," X said.
He reached out for something to hold on to, but the only other thing to grab was the mast, which wouldn't do him any good. Clinging to the hatch, he prepared for the next wave. He couldn't see over the cabin forming the bow of the boat and had no idea when it would hit. The vessel climbed again, engines purring beneath the deck, straining against the rough water.
"X, I highly recommend you come back inside before..."
X cut Timothy off.
"And I'd highly advise you not to give me orders, Pepper."
The boat rose onto a wave, and X gripped the handle tighter, gritted his teeth, and waited. This time, the bow slapped back down so hard, water broke over the top of the cabin. He looked up through the spray as lightning slashed the sky, illuminating a wall of waves in front of them.
"Magnolia, take over for Timothy," he ordered.
"But..."
"Do it, Mags. I trust you over him. No offense, Pepper."
"None taken, sir," Timothy replied.
Still clinging to the handle, X looked over his shoulder at the hatch leading back into the boat. It wasn't even 20 feet away, but he couldn't risk getting flung over the side, not even with the rope hitched to his armor.
"X, you should follow Timothy's suggestion and get back inside," Magnolia said.
"That's a negative, Mags. I'm going inside the battery room."
Static crackled over the channel with her reply.
"Okay, but do it soon."
X prepared to open the hatch and climb inside. He couldn't risk flooding the compartment. While he waited for the right moment, his eyes darted to the razor wire on the rails. He had looped the wire there to protect them from sea creatures. But if he should get caught in it... The boat rose up on a wave again, lifting X to a fleeting view of the ocean in all directions. Miles of dark, churning water surrounded the tiny boat. In the wake of a lightning flash, he thought he saw something moving in the murk. Slapping back down, the vessel creaked from the impact. Although he had braced himself, the force still rattled his bones. He shook off the shock. Magnolia continued bringing the boat about, but the damage was already done. A sensor beeped over the comm system, and X didn't need to hear her frantic report to know the Seawolf had taken damage.
We've got a crack in the right hull, she said, sealing it off. A clanking sounded, and he looked up as the sailmast began to extend, the three-piece pole rising toward the storm clouds.
What the hell is happening? X shouted. The mast is rising.
Must have malfunctioned, Magnolia quickly replied. I can't stop it. X looked back down at the hatch. He had to get inside before the mast took a lightning bolt and fried him where he stood. He spent the next few seconds timing the waves and waiting for his opportunity to climb inside. X, I'm picking something up on... The rest of her transmission cut off. He clicked the handle left and pulled the hatch open. With seconds to spare, he unclipped his tether and turned to climb inside when his peripheral vision caught a darting movement over the port gunwale. In the split second it took his mind to process what he was seeing, a thick, sucker-covered arm the size of a tree trunk slapped the deck and quickly slithered back over the railing, taking a coil of razor wire with it.
What in the hell?
He mumbled. His pounding heart skipped as three more arms curled out of the water and rose above the railings. These weren't the snake-like creatures from the swamps. These were all arms of the same beast. X, something's attached to the boat, Magnolia shouted. Something...
big? Yeah, I see it.
X finally ducked into the hatch and had started to close it when one of the arms grabbed the handle, forcing it open. A third arm curled around the mast, twisting and curling its way to the top where it bent the pole just below the crow's nest. Using all his strength, X tried to force the hatch shut, but the seawolf crested another wave and came slamming back down, dislodging X from the hatch and lofting him into the air. He flailed for something to hold on to. With the rope gone, he had nothing to hold him steady. He crashed onto the deck, sliding as soon as he hit. The port rail stopped him with the clunk of his rifle on metal. The impact knocked the air from his lungs, and red encroached on the edges of his vision. When it cleared, he had no more than an eye blink to avoid another arm darting over the deck. Kicking it away, he pushed himself up and fought his way back to the hatch leading inside the boat. Lurching past one of the spear guns, he grabbed it, his boot sliding on the slick deck. He swiveled the weapon toward the nearest arm and harpooned the meaty flesh. A howl rose above the cacophony of the storm. The voice of a monster. The dark, dead seas weren't so dead after all. It was why he had brought such weapons with him. He grabbed the hatch to the cabin, opened it, and slammed it shut. An arm crashed into the metal a moment later. Backing away, X unslung his rifle and flinched as an arm hit the hatch again. X, get down here, Magnolia shouted from the command room. Keeping the barrel aimed at the hatch, he backpedaled over to the ladder. Then he climbed down to the lower deck and bolted for the command center. A wave smacked the starboard hull, and he thumped into a bulkhead. Stars broke before his vision, but he kept going to the next hatch. Inside the control room, Magnolia gripped the wheel and stared at the glass. She had flipped the beams back on, and the bright glow captured the side view of a meaty orange body covered in flaps and bumps. X, she stammered. What the hell is that? Miles was up and growling at the glass. Part of the sea creature had surfaced, giving them a view of glistening flesh crisscrossed in deep scars. Longitudinal wrinkles and flaps covered its mantle and narrower head.
Pepper can probably answer better than I can, X said.
I believe it's an enteroctopus, or a giant octopus, the AI replied.
The massive cephalopod tightened its grip around the seawolf's twin hulls. It reminded him of another monster. Not as big and with fewer arms, but a monster all the same. El Pulpo, king of the Cazadores. Something in his gut told him they were getting closer to the Metal Islands.
This creature does not register in my database, Timothy replied after a few seconds' pause.
Thick arms covered in scars pulled the boat closer to a gaping hooked beak. The monstrous beast brought a tire-size eyeball to the windshield. Magnolia turned the wheel to the right, but the rudders didn't respond. The engines whined.
Stop, X said, holding out a hand. You're going to burn them out.
I'm detecting a problem with engine 2, Timothy said. I recommend shutting it off.
Magnolia looked over to X.
Do it and get back, he said.
Ever so slowly, Magnolia unbuckled her harness. The enormous eye with the strange elongated pupil followed her actions,
and before she or X could react, an arm slapped against the windshield. Spiderwebs spread across the reinforced glass, which cracked audibly from the impact. Magnolia moved out of the seat, and X shouldered his rifle, training the muzzle on the bulbous, lump-covered head of the giant octopus.
"Take Miles into your quarters," X said. "Timothy, you take control of the boat as soon as I get done with this fucker."
"What do you mean, when you get done with it?" Magnolia asked, not moving. "Sir, I don't think your weapons will have much," Timothy started to say. Water trickled through the cracked glass as a long arm smacked the window again. This time, its suction cups pulled away a triangular chunk of glass, letting in the howling wind and salt spray.
"Go, Mags!" X shouted.
He moved his finger to the trigger, held in his breath, and fired at the huge elliptical eye. Michael Everhart stabbed the rotted melon with his garden fork and blinked away the sweat in his eyes. The diseased fruit splattered the dirt with green and red mush. A bright glow from the ceiling-mounted grow lights captured the depressing scene. Other workers were carting off their first crop. The hybrid seeds had resulted in large melons, but a disease had putrefied the fruit.
"What the hell happened?" asked Cole Mintel.
The burly middle-aged man had joined the new team of farmers on Deliverance to help get the produce growing. He rolled up his sleeves, exposing strong forearms shaped by a lifetime working with wood. Michael shook his head as he examined the three rows of melons. "Some sort of blight, I guess." Cole looked over the open space at the other crops. 12 rows of corn were already maturing, and plump, healthy red tomatoes hung from dark green vines. A large patch of potatoes had already begun to break through the rust-hued dirt. "We'll be fine," Michael said. "We'll try the melons again, or maybe we'll try something else." He scooped the mess into a bag and handed it to Cole, who was collecting the ruined fruit. The older man hadn't said much since losing his son 2 months ago, and Michael could tell he had lost his passion for woodworking. Lately, he spent more time at the farm than in his shop.
"How's your wife?" Michael asked. We miss Roger."
"I miss him, too. He was like an older brother to me."
Michael put a hand on Cole's shoulder. He seemed to sulk under the touch.
"His sacrifice saved a lot of lives," Michael said.
Cole nodded again.
"I better get these to the composters."
"Right." Michael watched the man leave and let out a sigh. They had lost too many friends over the past few months. Commander Rick Weaver, Andrew Bolden, Roger Mintel, Ty Parker. The list went on and on. But a ghost from the past had returned. As if in partial compensation for all the heartbreak and sacrifices, Xavier Rodriguez had come back from the dead. Humanity now had a future, an uncertain one to be sure, but there was hope. The most dangerous of emotions. Michael pulled the shirt from around his waist and used the bunched material to wipe the sweat from his forehead.
"Commander Everhart!"
He followed the voice to the clean room entrance where Lieutenant Les Mitchells had ducked under the flap.
"Sir, you're needed on the bridge."
"I'll be there in an hour," Michael replied.
Les remained where he was, and even at this distance, Michael could see the worry in his eyes.
"Give me a few minutes," Michael said.
That seemed to satisfy Les, who slipped back into the clean room. Throwing on his shirt, Michael picked his way through the rows of crops, careful not to step on a stem or tendril. He felt eyes following him across the dirt. Most of the crew didn't understand why he spent his time off from diving and engineering to work in this place. But for Michael, farming had become therapeutic. Every tomato he held in his hand, every stem of potatoes he pulled from the ground, and every apple he plucked from their tree was a tangible success, something you could smell and taste. Something that sustained the human race. Layla joined him here from time to time, but she didn't love it the way he did. She preferred to be in the new library aboard Deliverance, combing the archives and learning about the history of a destroyed world. Michael got out of his work clothes, cleaned off, and then threw on his red coveralls. Walking through the corridors, he drew looks from nearly everyone he passed. There weren't many helldivers left. And even though Michael was helping in the effort to recruit new ones, The divers would never reach the numbers they had during his father's tenure under X. The real legends were almost all dead now. Two workers painting a bulkhead outside the farm stopped to salute Michael. He simply nodded and continued on his way. After Captain Jordan's death, both ships had returned to the roots of the Hive. The artwork was being restored, and destroyed and deleted archives were slowly being recovered. But there was still much work to be done. Michael turned down a passage still being retrofitted into new quarters. More workers in yellow uniforms were carrying equipment into the small rooms, preparing them for their new tenants. A third of the Hive's population had already moved into quarters on Deliverance. There were still issues to deal with, primarily involving lower deckers who felt that they got the short end of the stick in reassignment. But the committee formed to deal with such issues was working every day to make sure food, medical care, and shelter were being distributed equitably. For the first time in recent memory, the passengers of the two airships were experiencing something that approached an egalitarian society. Now that they had a second ship, there were more jobs. More jobs meant more food. More food meant a healthier population. A healthier population meant that Michael had a stronger pool of possible recruits for the next Helldivers team. Some days, he was really starting to feel that there was still hope for the human race, especially now that X and Magnolia were on the surface looking for a permanent home. He pulled his long hair back into a ponytail before approaching the hatch to the bridge. Only one militia soldier stood guard. Another sign of change. With Jordan's henchmen either in the brig or dead on the surface in Florida, there was no reason to have a bulky security force. The executive team had reassigned most of the militia to other jobs, such as farming. The hatch opened, and Michael walked out onto the clean bridge, blinking in the dim light. Layla stood at the helm beside their new captain, Katrina.
"Commander Everhart on deck," said one of the officers.
Katrina and Layla both turned to face him, and both smiled, though the smiles seemed fraught, almost forced. In an instant, the optimism he had felt rising inside him drained away.
"Captain," Michael said. "Follow me, Commander," Katrina said.
Layla remained at the command center while Michael followed the captain into the small conference room off the bridge, not bothering to ask why she wanted to meet with him personally. It could be any of 100 things, since the ships were always one step away from disaster. But this time it wasn't an engineering problem, or a new strain of flu afflicting the passengers, or a lower decker resentful about reassignment.
"We just received a distress call from the Seawolf," Katrina said. "Something happened to them, Michael."
His heart sank at the news. Everything had been going so well. But Michael had learned long ago that life was seldom fair.
"We tried to hail them," Katrina said, "but their radio is either damaged or offline. Right now we have no way of knowing what happened."
She put a hand on his shoulder.
"I wanted you to know. I loved X once, too."
Her eyes flitted to the deck.
"A part of me will always love him."
Michael blinked back a tear. He stiffened, trying his best to stay strong, because that was exactly what X would want him to do.
"Try not to worry," Katrina said. "If anyone can survive out there, it's Commander Rodriguez."
2. A violent shaking startled Magnolia awake. She coughed up a mouthful of salt water, gagged, coughed again. A curtain of short-cropped blue hair hung over her face, blocking her view. She pulled it back and looked up at the blinking emergency light spreading its pulsing red glow over the room. Between blinks, she spotted the wet, furry heap that was Miles. The dog lay a few feet away, curled up, unmoving.
"Miles," she whispered.
Reaching out, she nudged him, and he let out a whimper and moved a leg. That was good. At least he was still alive and could move. But where was X? Magnolia touched the goose egg on the back of her head and winced. She pulled away fingers slick with blood. She had taken a beating and had no idea how long she was out.
"Timothy, do you copy?"
Magnolia said. There was no answer but the creaking of bulkheads. At first she couldn't remember why she was inside her quarters with Miles, but an otherworldly call reminded her. The screeches of the giant octopus carried through the small vessel,
but something about this melancholy sound was different from the one she had heard in the command center. The scent of smoke drifted below decks. That got her attention. She pushed herself up in the puddle of cold water, cursing a blue streak that would have made X proud.
X, where the hell are you?
Miles tried to get up too, but slipped and fell in the water, splashing it over Magnolia's black fatigues. She helped him up onto a bunk and told him to stay put. Then she fumbled her way over to the hatch and opened it to a passageway that was ankle-deep in seawater. Another emergency light winked outside the command center. The hatch was ajar, providing a view inside the room. The red swirl from the light fell over standing water and a shattered windshield. A fail-safe mechanism had activated, covering the broken glass with a metal hatch to keep the water out, and at the same time blocking her view of the dark sea.
"Timothy," she said. The AI did not respond.
She closed the hatch and sealed it to keep the rest of the boat from flooding, then began her search for X. The ladder to the upper deck was slick, and a quick glance revealed that it wasn't just water. Blood coated the rungs. She climbed to the staging area and stepped cautiously into the dark space. There were no emergency lights up here, and all the porthole windows were sealed off with metal hatches.
"X," she said quietly, but firmly.
There was no response. She reached into her cargo pocket and pulled out a small flashlight, which she pointed at the floor. A trail of blood led to the hatch.
"X, you son of a..."
She hurried over to a gun rack, freed her carbine, and slapped a full magazine into it. The gun felt good in her hands, but she wasn't sure the rounds were going to do much against such a massive beast. The hatch opened to darkness and a spray of cold water that hit her face. Howling wind greeted her as she stepped onto the deck with her rifle shouldered and the flashlight clamped against the stock. The trail of blood ended on the deck, where the ocean water had washed away any further evidence. She played the beam back and forth, but X was nowhere to be seen.
"X!" she shouted, but her voice was lost in the howling wind.
The Seawolf swayed as she took her first step out. The engines continued to propel the craft through the mountainous waves that crashed and rose over and over.
"X!" she yelled again.
Her light fell on a limp arm, lined with suction cups, nailed by a spear to the rail. Another tentacle hung off the cabin behind her, severed and dripping red off the second deck. Her flashlight moved to the gore spattered behind the main mast. Smoke rose away from a charred spot and a gaping rent in the deck.
"Oh, shit," she whispered.
The damage was without a doubt the result of a grenade. The blast had blown off two more of the creature's arms and a hunk of meat that she didn't recognize.
"X, where are you?"
she yelled, frantic now. A reply came over the wind.
"Megs!"
The voice was faint but recognizable. She hurried over to the side of the boat, cautious not to slide into the razor wire. Lowering her rifle, she used her flashlight to scan the ocean.
"Megs!"
X yelled again. But this wasn't coming from over the side. She looked up at the top of the bent mast and spotted X hanging on to the crow's nest. Another torn tentacle was wrapped around the metal lookout, part of it coiled around his leg.
"You crazy bastard," Magnolia whispered.
She stared for a second, but quickly moved away from the side of the boat. Judging by the spatter around her, the beast was dead. But if she had learned one thing over her years of diving and fighting, it was never to turn her back on a monster. With the rifle up and trained on the starboard rail, she backpedaled to the mizzenmast, boots slapping in the constant wash.
"That thing's still out there," she called up.
"Nope, nothing but fish bait now,"
he shouted. She stopped when she got to the mast.
"You need me to come get you, or are you coming down from there?"
X swung his legs over the side of the crow's nest and kicked the hanging arm, but the suction cups had him and wouldn't let go, even in death. She kept an eye on the rails on both sides of the Seawolf as X made his way down the bent main mast. One of the engines was still running, but if they continued losing power, they would be forced to use the sails, which was going to be difficult with the main mast so severely compromised. The mizzenmast looked fine, but if they lost the engines, they would need both sails. A beeping came from her wrist monitor, and she held up the cracked screen to see the radar come online. The small computer was synced with the boat, and she had manually created a program to go off if the radar picked up anything. Her heart leaped at the small green bleeps east of their position.
X, we got a problem, she said.
Yeah, I accidentally blew a small hole in the boat, I know. But I had no choice. And the mast is bent.
He jumped to the deck and, pulling a machete from the sheath on his back, cut away the yard of octopus arms still clinging to his leg.
No, we got other problems.
I know this already, Mags.
Magnolia held her monitor in his face.
Ah, damn, he shouted.
Either that thing was just a baby or it brought a lot of friends, she said.
I'm gonna need more grenades.
The boat swayed from side to side as they rushed back across the deck to the staging area and armory. Magnolia followed him down the ladder and into the passageway.
Where's Miles?
X shouted.
In my bunk.
Magnolia opened the hatch.
You okay, boy?
X said, bending down by his dog. Tail whipping, Miles confirmed that he was just fine. X led them back to the command center and took a seat in front of a console dripping with water. The metal hatch now covered the cracked and shattered windshield.
Timothy must be offline, she said.
Shit, just when we need him.
X punched at the screen to reboot the system while Magnolia checked the navigation screen and the contacts to the east. Timothy's voice suddenly crackled from the console.
Sir, I am unable to retract the mainmast.
That's because it's bent,
X said. He looked over to Magnolia.
Those contacts seem funny to you.
What do you mean? Mags asked.
They aren't moving toward us. We're moving toward them.
X reached forward and flipped the metal latch off the windshield. Another flip of a switch activated the searchlight beams. They penetrated deep into the darkness, capturing mountains above the waves on the horizon. These mountains weren't more waves or giant sea creatures or anything else that moved.
Dry land, Timothy said. We found another island chain.
Magnolia studied the jagged silhouettes.
You think this is the Metal Islands? She asked.
X shook his head.
I don't see the sun, and it's only 5 o'clock.
Magnolia picked up the radio handset.
I'll inform the captain.
She pushed the button several times, but it wouldn't come on.
The radio has been damaged, Timothy said. I've activated the distress beacon, but we have no way of contacting the airships.
Why the hell did you do that? X said. Now they're gonna worry about us and possibly even send help. Help that we don't need.
Magnolia didn't reply right away, but she couldn't hold back her thoughts.
X, I hate to break it to you, but we do need help. The boat has some serious damage.
I do not want them sending anyone. It was my decision to come out here, and you made your choice too, Mags.
She put down the radio handset, realization setting in.
You don't want Michael to come after you, do you?
You just figured this out.
So what if we find the Metal Islands, then what?
X didn't reply. He grumbled to himself under his breath. Magnolia was used to that. X still acted crazy from time to time. She had been fine with his rants and his conversations with himself, even when he screamed at night. But it was happening more often, and he was really starting to scare her. She looked back at the islands. She wasn't sure what was out there, but whatever it was, they would have to face it on their own. Captain DeVita wouldn't be coming to help them, nor would Tin and Layla. The storms in this area made a rescue mission impossible, and diving through the clouds was a death sentence.
Pepper, shut that distress signal off, he ordered.
Sir, if we do that, they won't be able to track us.
That's the point, X replied. We can fix the boat on our own. Now do it, or I'm shutting you off for good.
Magnolia saw the anger in X's face, and for the first time on the journey, she felt the tendrils of despair creeping in. What had started off as a new adventure to locate a place for humanity to call home and a chance to avenge Roger was turning into a nightmare. She just hoped she could trust X to do the right thing if they found the Metal Islands. Les Mitchells pulled on the cuffs of his white uniform as he approached the brig with his wife, Catherine, and 7-year-old daughter, Phil. Both of them had recovered from their cough weeks ago and were slowly regaining their strength. But they both had a long way to go, especially Phil, who had lost almost 10 pounds and looked like a stick.
Catherine brushed back a strand of dirty blonde hair and heaved a sigh as they stopped outside the brig. Today was a big day for the Mitchells family, for today they were to be reunited with Trey, who had spent nearly a year in the brig for stealing from the trading post. Captain DeVita had greatly reduced his sentence after Trey's vital help in overthrowing Captain Jordan, but they couldn't just let him out, even with his father now serving as executive officer on Deliverance. To keep the system working as it was designed to work, the rule of law had to be respected. Les wrapped the hatch with his fist, and Lauren Sloan, the recently promoted sergeant of the militia, opened it, her lazy eye moving from Les to Catherine to Phil. "Wait out here," she grumbled, clearly unimpressed with Les's new rank as lieutenant of Deliverance. Les smiled at his wife and bent down slightly to wrap his tall daughter in a hug.
"Is Trey really coming home with us?" Phil asked, looking up with her hazel eyes.
"He sure is."
Catherine returned the smile with one of her contagious grins and put her arms around Les and Phil. They were still huddled together when Trey finally emerged. 2 months shy of his 18th birthday, and the boy was the thinnest Les had ever seen him. Even thinner than Phil.
"Hi," Trey said, his voice timid.
"My baby,"
Catherine said, pulling away from Les to hug her son.
"Trey, you look really..."
Phil said, but Sloan interrupted her.
"Sign here and you can be on your way, kid," she said, handing Trey a clipboard.
He let go of his mother long enough to sign his name to the page. And just like that, Trey Mitchells was free.
"Man, your boy is a man,"
Les thought. He exchanged a nod with Sloan. He respected her for helping them take down Captain Jordan, and she had treated Trey with dignity. It wasn't her fault the rations for prisoners were barely enough to survive on.
"Congratulations again on your promotion," he said.
She shrugged.
"Just means more work for me."
She gave a mirthless grin.
"Congratulations on your promotion as well, LT.
"Thanks," Les replied. Her lazy eyes stopped on Trey.
"Stay out of trouble, kid," she said.
"I plan to, Sergeant."
Les put his hand on his son's back and herded his family away from the brig on the hive, anxious to get them all together around the small table in their quarters. Although he worked on Deliverance now, he, like many of the other Helldivers and officers, had opted to remain living on the hive. Something about deserting the airship had felt wrong, and when given the opportunity for a new cabin on Deliverance, he had politely declined. A smile broke across his face at the sight of fresh paint on the bulkheads. Trey grinned too, seeing the fresh artwork covering the metal with images of the old world. Fluffy clouds, exotic animals, and cities.
"How are you feeling?"
Catherine asked Trey. His smile broadened.
"I'm just glad to be out of that hellhole and back with my family."
They arrived at their home a few minutes later, where a meal of guinea pig stew, fresh bread, and warm potatoes waited. They even had a healthy spread of butter. Les hadn't eaten butter for as long as he could remember.
"I bet you're hungry," Phil said.
"You look like a beanpole."
"Takes one to know one," Trey replied.
He brushed his long hair out of his face and pulled out the familiar creaky wooden chair he had always sat on for meals.
"We need to get you a haircut and a bath," Catherine said. "I'll eat, bathe, and then I'm off. I want to see Commander Everhart," Trey said.
Les took a seat at the head of the table, studying his son in the glow of the single bulb dangling from the overhead. The friendship between the two young men went way back, but Les found it odd his son would want to see Michael right after leaving the brig, unless...
"For what?" Les asked.
"I've had a lot of time to think about what I'm going to do with my life," Trey said.
He looked over at his mother, who had stopped scooping stew into bowls. She looked just as nervous as Les felt about whatever this was that Trey had decided behind bars. He was hoping his son would reapply to engineering school or come to work on the bridge with him, but his gut told him Trey wasn't interested in either of those opportunities.
"I'll tell you after we eat," Trey said, licking his lips. "I'm starving."
Catherine finished pouring the stew and distributed the bowls one by one. They bowed their heads together and held hands just as humans had done centuries earlier.
"I'm thankful today to have my son Trey back home, and our entire family together once again," Les said,
Today I pray to whatever god might be out there to keep the hive and deliverance in the sky long enough for Xavier and Magnolia to find us a new home.
He let go of Trey's and Phil's hands and waited for Trey to tell them of his decision, but the boy was busy shoveling food in his mouth.
"Mom," he said with his mouth full of stew, "this is so good.
We were lucky to get a guinea pig. First time we've had meat in months." Phil took a bite of bread, but she still hadn't touched her stew.
"What's wrong, sweetheart?" Catherine asked.
"I don't feel so good." Phil looked up at her brother.
"Your stomach feels sick?" Les asked.
Phil shook her head and put her hand on her chest.
"It's my heart. It hurts. I miss Trey really bad, and now I'm worried he's going to leave us again."
Trey laid his hand on Phil's.
"I'm not going to leave you guys again, I promise."
"But you told me you want to be a helldiver," Phil said. "And helldivers die."
Les suddenly felt his own heart grow heavy.
"Is this true, son?"
"Yes."
Trey laid his fork with a skewered new potato down on the table.
"I've decided it's the best way to give back to the ship and my family. We'll get more rations and..."
"I'm the XO now, Trey," Les said, cutting him off. "You don't have to risk your life." Trey's lip quivered.
"We can't afford to lose you, Dad. And I know for a fact you'll keep diving despite your new title. I heard Sloan talking about it."
Les couldn't dispute that. He had agreed to remain a helldiver when he accepted the position of XO.
"It's time for me to be a man," Trey said. "It's time for me to take your place as a helldiver."
Catherine looked across the table at Les, her eyes pleading with him to talk some sense into the boy. But his son was no longer a child. He had helped overthrow Jordan, had served his time in the brig, and was now free to do what he wanted. Les wiped the corner of his mouth and put his handkerchief on the table. Today was supposed to be a joyful reunion and a wonderful meal with his family, but he had lost his appetite. After finally getting his son back, the thought of him diving into the apocalypse made him feel sick.
Katrina DeVita was starting to feel at home on the Bridge of Deliverance. All around her, officers worked at their stations in the circular space, monitoring the skies for storms, watching the life support systems on the ship, and communicating with the crew of the Hive. Technically, she was the captain of both ships, but she had chosen to lead from this control room. For the first few weeks, she had tried to work on the clean white bridge of the Hive. It was larger and comfortably familiar, but that familiarity was the problem. Memories of her former lover, Captain Leon Jordan, made working there too painful. If she was going to focus on saving the human race and leaving a positive legacy as captain, she needed to do it aboard Deliverance. The Hive would always be her home, but she needed a fresh start. She had considered adding a new captain to the Hive, but had no one she could entrust with the job quite yet. Former Lieutenant Hunt and Ensign Ryan were serving time in the brig for conspiracy convictions, and everyone else was too green. Humans continued to let her down. That was why she had transferred the AI Timothy Pepper from the Hilltop Bastion to the other airship to serve as her co-captain. She knew that the ship was in good hands with the AI, and being able to trust Timothy allowed her to concentrate on the most important part of her job, keeping the two airships in the air. Today she had a few things on her plate. Shortly she would check the finished renovations of 40 new living quarters on the ship. When finished, they would house over 100 people from the Hive, bringing the total occupancy on Deliverance to just shy of 200. The other 273 passengers would remain on the Hive. But now she had a bigger problem on her hand than just angry civilians chafing under what they saw as unequal treatment. Katrina made her way over to the comms station, where Ada Winslow, a 20-year-old engineering student turned communications officer, sat in a chair facing the radio equipment. After losing the experience of Ensign Ryan and Lieutenant Hunt, Katrina had been forced to pull several new staff members straight from the school. Ada was at the top of her class, and though she hadn't majored in communications, she learned quickly.
"Ensign Winslow, have we heard anything from Commander Rodriguez or Miss Khatib?"
Ada twisted, her brown eyes eager to help.
"Negative, Captain. I've been combing the channels all evening just in case they are trying to broadcast on a different frequency, but nothing so far. Keep trying.
Katrina gave her a reassuring nod. She made her way down the line of new crew members. Ensign Dave Connor, a 40-year-old engineer who had lost his leg in an accident involving one of the Hive's turbofans, manned the navigation system, tapping his prosthetic leg on the deck. He also doubled as a weatherman and was an expert at reading the storms, which made him invaluable to her.
"How are the skies looking?" she asked.
"Ma'am," Dave said, exposing a mostly full set of yellow teeth. "Winds out of the south at 8 knots. Barometer has dropped slightly. I'm detecting an electrical storm that appears to be along a 50-mile front. We're keeping our distance, but if we get any closer, we're in for a rocky ride."
"Keep an eye on that storm and let me know if anything changes."
"Will do, ma'am." Katrina continued to the next officer, Ensign Bronson White. By far the oldest man on the ship, he seemed to be named for the color of his thick hair and beard. Thick spectacles magnified his pale blue eyes. He was the former chief engineer of the ship, replaced by Samson upon his retirement 10 years ago.
"Ensign," Katrina said.
Bronson nodded politely.
"How are you this evening, Captain?"
"I'm well. How are our ships?"
He shifted his glasses down his nose to look at the display.
"Gas bladders on the Hive are all functioning properly, and the engines on Deliverance are fully operational. We haven't had to use a turbofan on the Hive for several days."
"And the supports are holding firmly?" she asked, referring to the aluminum struts that engineering had used to tie the two ships together.
"Yes, Captain."
Katrina patted White's shoulder before walking away. Layla Brower was the other crew member working the night shift, and by her slouched posture and tired eyes it was obvious she missed Michael. But Katrina needed Layla on deck tonight. Her job was an important one, using the new archives from Deliverance to restore the archives that Jordan had destroyed. Tonight she was also working with Sergeant Sloan of the militia to keep the peace on the airship.
"How's it going?" Katrina asked.
Layla shook her head.
"It's been quiet so far, but the night is still young. We have 4 soldiers on patrol throughout Deliverance and another 10 on the Hive."
Not a lot of boots, but to Katrina's thinking, the fewer the better, especially since the militia had willingly carried out Captain Jordan's orders to kill Janga, Ty Parker, and many others. The passengers didn't trust the militia, and that made Katrina's job as captain difficult. Very difficult. It did help that she had been the one to kill Jordan. But even this had not gained her the trust of everyone, especially former lower deckers. Missing from the bridge was Lieutenant Les Mitchell, who was with his family celebrating his son's release from the brig. It was a happy day for the Mitchellses, and one that Katrina was glad to finally see. Ordering Trey back to his cell after he had helped overthrow Jordan was difficult, but she had to be fair. Shortening his sentence by a year was the best she could do without upsetting other passengers who had family members serving time. Katrina went back to the captain's chair and sat. Her crew was new, with both young and old officers. But they were her team, and she was proud to have them working with her. They had been granted a new beginning with Deliverance, but no matter how well things were going in the sky, their future really depended on what was happening on the surface. If X and Magnolia were dead, then the one shot at finding the Metal Islands was over before it really began.
"Ensign Connor, bring up our current location on screen," she ordered.
The wall-mounted monitor in front of her chair flashed to life, showing an old-world map. The airships were still flying about 50 miles off the coast of Florida. A curved red line showed the location of the Seawolf ever since Deliverance dropped the vessel into the water. X had sailed southeast from Florida between Cuba and the Bahamas. They were just west of the Turks and Caicos Islands when the distress signal activated, but it had shut off not long after being turned on. She wasn't sure precisely where they were now, but it had to be close to those islands. Pushing another button on her monitor, she pulled up the weather overlay map. A red cloud swallowed most of the screen, intensifying over Cuba and the Bahamas. X had seen this map. He knew what he was getting himself into, and that was why he had opted for the route between the islands. Another dense fog of red covered most of Jamaica, Hispaniola, and Puerto Rico. Only a small chain called the Virgin Islands was visible in the blur. In her mind's eye, Katrina pictured the nuclear-tipped missiles striking each of the larger islands 2.5 centuries ago, incinerating millions of people and destroying in minutes what had taken humanity an eon to create. But maybe the smaller groups like the one on the map hadn't been touched. Maybe it was some sort of Goldilocks zone that had been deemed not worth destroying, and maybe the radiation and electrical storms never reached this place. Or maybe it was just another mutated wasteland. The sound of the hatches opening pulled her away from her reflections. Les ducked under the bulkhead and walked onto the bridge, his normally pale cheeks red. Katrina knew right away something was wrong. She rose from her chair. "Captain," he said.
"It was a quick dinner," she replied.
"How's Trey?" Les sighed at his boots.
"He wants to be a hell diver."
Katrina stroked her jaw. She remembered the look on her father's face when she had told him the same thing. He wasn't happy about it. But he hadn't lived long after she decided to join the ranks of the divers.
"Trey is a man now and has to make his own way," she replied.
Les swallowed, his prominent Adam's apple bobbing, and rubbed his tuft of red hair.
"I know. Try not to worry, Lieutenant. The next time we dive, it will be into a green zone, and even if Trey does decide to go through with this, it will be months before he dives. Besides, we have bigger problems right now."
She motioned for Les to follow her over to the central table. "Listen up, everyone," she said. Layla, Dave, Ada, and Bronson all stood to attention at their stations. Even the older ensign, who had a natural slouch, stood ramrod straight.
"As a few of you already know, we have received a distress beacon from Commander Rodriguez and Miss Khatib. The last ping we got from their distress beacon was just west of the Turks and Caicos Islands before it went offline. For now, only a few of us, including Commander Everhart, are privy to this information, and for now I want to keep it that way."
"Should we change course, Captain?" Layla asked.
"No, we hold steady where we are. The electrical storms in this area are too dangerous to try mounting a rescue op. X and Magnolia are on their own for now."
"The Sea Wolf is our best hope of finding a new home for humanity," Layla said. Katrina sighed.
"I know this, but X and Magnolia can take care of themselves. Right now, we need to focus on keeping our ships in the sky."
Her words trailed off as realization set in. Her predecessor had often used that same line. The thought chilled her. So this was how it felt to lead the final bastion of civilization. The burden of having so many lives in her hands wasn't even the worst part of leading. It was the secrets she had uncovered on Deliverance that she still hadn't told to anyone. 3. The island sure didn't look like a potential home for the human race. X stood in the off-kilter crow's nest 20 feet above the Sea Wolf, roving his rifle scope across the shoreline and looking for any sign of the Cazadores or Sirens. The same bleak scene from back on the mainland filled the scope. A cold, dead world the color of rust waited on the other side of a wide bay. Along the base of a mountain, the ruins of a city stood at the far edge of a gray beach. The crumbling structures weren't blackened from the nuclear fires, but the years had not been kind to them. It was a place of broken windows, sinking foundations, rotted wood, and cracked roadways, just like every city he had ever seen. The jungle had crept into the heart of the town, covering most of the structures in vines and red foliage. No, there weren't any Cazadores here. This wasn't the metal islands that El Pulpo had spoken of back in Florida. This was just another radioactive old-world city, cursed to die in the darkness. And once again, X had no choice but to scavenge the wastes while nursing an injury. Blood crusted around his arm where a suction cup had held him tight enough to draw blood through his skin. And his flesh wasn't the only part of him injured. Smoke fingered away from the stern of the Sea Wolf, swirling into the storm clouds above. The vessel had taken severe damage in the storm and the attack. He had blown a 3-by-3-foot hole on the port side with the grenade that killed the giant octopus, flaying open the metal deck and splattering the rail with hunks of gore stuck in the barbed wire. Even worse, Engine 2 was destroyed, and Battery 2 was at 0% charge.
"Pepper, how long will Battery 1 last us?" X asked over the open channel.
Battery 1 is currently showing an 80% charge, which should last roughly 2 more weeks before requiring a recharge.
X twisted for a better view of the deck,